and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for April 29th, 2011. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, are dolphins too smart for captivity? Organic light-emitting transistors, and we read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about what causes crowd quakes, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
So I've written a story about whether dolphins are too smart for captivity.
Science's David Graham reports in this week's issue on a new movement to end all research on dolphins in zoos and aquariums.
The issue here is that there's just a very small handful of animals that are so smart that they are essentially in a class of their own, or at least considered so smart they're in a class of their own. And included in that would be humans, also chimpanzees, elephants, and recently dolphins have entered that picture. And the issue becomes for researchers, once they begin to realize how smart these animals are, is it still ethical to keep these animals in captivity, to keep what is essentially maybe something that is as smart and self-aware as a human being locked up?
So this story is about dolphins. What, if any, research is allowed on other intelligent populations of captive animals, the elephants or primates that you mentioned?
Well, captive research is still going on with elephants and primates. Elephants that are in zoos are considered captive because they're not out there in the wild or they're not out there in a sanctuary. Their environment is very restricted. And chimpanzees also, the environment can vary. There are some labs in the U.S. where chimpanzees are in a facility, but they have access to the outdoors. It's a limited enclosure, but it's not like they're in a cage all day. But in other facilities, their movement is much more restricted. That's become increasingly unpopular amongst the public in recent years because the public, in addition to scientists, have begun to learn, as scientists release their discoveries, how smart especially chimpanzees are, and they're being compared with humans. Their genome is, for all intents and purposes, almost identical to ours, save for a few percent. And so when the public starts equating these animals with people, then you wouldn't want one of your relatives to, say, be locked up in a cage for its entire lifetime or even in a very small room or a small house.
Well, what are the metrics for measuring the harm done to a captive population of animals?
Well, that's a good question. And the reason this is a controversial issue is because what I just said is what some people would argue, that these animals are so much like people that they can't be locked up. But what the other side would say is that these animals are actually happy in captivity and that this is a lifestyle, if given the choice, they would prefer. And in fact, with the Navy's dolphins, the Navy keeps its dolphins not in facilities like a SeaWorld or something like that, but off of San Diego Bay, they actually have these large open water enclosures, which are still pens, but the dolphins are essentially in the ocean. They just have almost sort of like a wall or a net around them. But even in this case, the dolphins could actually, according to the Navy person I talked to, jump out of their pens fairly easily and swim away into the open ocean, and they don't. And he uses that to say, look, if these guys really wanted to be out there in the wild, they could easily do that. Other people have argued that dolphins reproduce very well in captivity, that they get 3 square meals a day, which is hard in the wild, that they are not being predated on by sharks. About 50% of dolphins in the wild have shark scars. Most marine mammals in captivity also get very good medical care, sometimes better than the medical care that you and I get, at least according to one of my sources for the story. So the other side would argue that these guys are treated very well in captivity, that they're happy there. These animals are stress-free. They're reproducing fabulously. What other standards do you want?
So far, then, what have researchers learned about the extent of dolphin intelligence?
Well, the thing that really sparked this article is a new movement being started by a dolphin researcher named Lori Marino. And what she's trying to do is launch a crusade that would free all dolphins and whales from captivity. Now, this may be something you've heard about before. Obviously, a lot of animal rights people would like to see that happen as well. But what's new this time around is that it's actually a scientist that's proposing this. And she's proposing this based on a lot of her own research. One of the most important studies she was involved in was a study about 10 years ago at the New York Aquarium. And there she and one of her colleagues, Diane Reese, conducted a series of experiments on a couple of bottlenose dolphins called Tab and Presley. And they did what's called called a mirror experiment. And what they essentially did was they scribbled a few marks on Tab and Presley on their foreheads, on their fins, on their backs, places the dolphins couldn't see. And then they put a mirror in the tank, and all of a sudden the dolphins immediately swam over to the mirror and they started twisting their bodies, and they were looking at all these marks on their bodies. Now, that may seem like sort of fun, not very interesting things that the dolphins did, but actually it was revolutionary what they did. There are almost no animals besides humans that have shown that they can recognize themselves in a mirror. In fact, only chimps and humans have been shown to be capable of this 10 years ago when the dolphin study was done. And what is important about this, what's called mirror self-recognition, is it's an indication that these animals aren't just instinctual creatures, that they actually have a concept of themselves, of their body. They are able to think about themselves and perhaps their place in the world. And this is a very sophisticated cognitive talent, which again has been shown in very, very few animals. And when Marino and Reese made this finding, that was the trigger for Marino to say, you know what, now I feel like I've learned enough to know that dolphins are highly intelligent, they're self-aware. For her, they were starting to approach people in many respects. And here she is studying these animals in a pretty confined environment. And she says to herself, you know what, I can no longer ethically justify keeping these animals in captivity. And from that point forward, she didn't do any more captive research. She still studies dolphins, but she studies dolphins that have died. So dolphins that wash up on beaches, that become stranded. Then she examines their brains, and she's made even more findings about dolphin intelligence doing this. She's found that, adjusted for their body size, dolphins actually have the second largest brains on the planet. That's just below humans and above chimpanzees. And they actually have very complex brains. And a lot of their brain structures that she's studied that are very complex have been linked to things like problem solving and even processing emotions in people. So there is just more and more research rolling in that says that not only are these guys smart, which we've known for a long time, but that their minds may work in very similar ways that our minds work in.
To what extent has research on dolphin intelligence been done with wild populations of dolphins in natural environments?
Well, that's the trick here, because what Marino is saying is she wants to end all captive research. And as a replacement for that, she wants dolphins and whales, too, to be only studied in the wild. Now, researchers have been studying dolphins and whales in the wild for decades, but what they've been mainly doing in the wild is research on dolphin physiology and behavior. Cognition research is a whole other animal. All research is hard, but cognition research is especially hard because you're trying to test mental capacity, and that's very hard to do just by snorkeling in the water with a dolphin, or, you know, just observing a dolphin, you know, once a month or every few years. You have to train these animals. You have to keep an eye on them constantly. You have to try to teach them new behaviors, which you can imagine it's relatively easy in a captive setting if a dolphin has your full attention. But in the wild, where you're just sort of waiting for a dolphin you know to swim back to you, or you're trying to find dolphins in the wild and you're trying to determine whether that dolphin's the same as another dolphin you just saw, incredibly difficult. And that's really the challenge for Marino and the allies that she's gathered for this revolution of sorts, is to show that the same high-quality cognition research can be done in the wild as can be done in captivity. And a lot of people on the other side of the debate don't think that she can do that. And as a result, they're saying that what her movement is ultimately going to do, if it's successful, is kill the field of dolphin cognition. Because all of a sudden, if all these animals are no longer in captivity and they're just in the wild and we can't study how their brains work in the wild, then we'll never learn anything new about how dolphins think, which they say would be a real shame just for our personal knowledge. But a lot of this information about dolphin intelligence and even their behavior is used to help rescue stranded dolphins. And as humans learn that dolphins are more intelligent and more like people, they may be more likely to participate in conservation efforts. So the other side is saying, look, if we stop this research in captivity, it's not only going to be bad for us, the researchers, but it's going to be bad for dolphins, because the less we know about them, the harder time we're going to have being able to protect them in the wild.
So it sounds like both research groups, those for captive research, those against captive research, they both have interests of dolphins in mind, but they just disagree about what's the best way forward.
Exactly. Everybody involved in this debate, regardless of what side they're on, they're all very interested in the welfare of these dolphins. It's really a question of where is the ethical line? And what Marino and her allies are saying is the ethical line is captivity. If these animals are in captivity, it's not ethical. And what the other group is saying is, no, that's not where the ethical line is. If we can treat them well in captivity, if we can learn a lot about them in captivity, if we can show they're happy in captivity, then it is ethical to study them in captivity. And this is a debate that will continue as we learn more about other animals. Dolphins aren't the last animal that this will be an issue for. There will be another animal in a few years that we discover is also highly intelligent, and researchers will deal with the ethical issues of keeping that animal in captivity too. So it's really an ongoing issue and one that's going to become increasingly important to debate as time goes on.
David Graham, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
Science's David Graham reports in this week's issue on a new movement to end all research on dolphins in zoos and aquariums. This week's Science Live is also on the topic. Find the online chat at news.sciencemag.org. The active matrix liquid crystal displays, or LCDs, in most flat-screen televisions, computer displays, laptops, and other handheld devices use a lot of power. The backlight is always on, and the liquid crystal pixels just let the light through or not. To save energy, researchers have been developing OLEDs, organic light-emitting diodes, in which the light is generated by each pixel. So when a pixel is off, it's not consuming power. But there's been some stagnation in the field because of the drive transistors that are used to power the OLED.
And those drive transistors, the material that's being used now in handheld displays, is polycrystalline silicon.
Andrew Rinsler is senior author of a paper in this week's Science that describes his team's use of carbon nanotubes for a new type of OLED transistor. I spoke with Rinsler from his office at the University of Florida, Gainesville.
And the trouble is that polycrystalline silicon, the grains are different sizes, different orientations, different number of grains as you move across larger areas. And so those give you inhomogeneities in the light output. And so consequently, even today in the OLEDs that are made for PDAs and cell phones, they have to throw out about 30% of them because of those inhomogeneity issues. And so we've developed a new technology that stands a pretty good chance of solving that.
The title of your paper is Low Voltage, Low Power Organic Light Emitting Transistors for Active Matrix Displays.
Right.
By low voltage and low power, how much of a savings does your team's transistor realize compared to other transistors driving these OLEDs?
So compared to polycrystalline silicon backplane transistors, our devices probably won't save any energy over those, but certainly compared to other organic transistor technologies, the closest competitor out there, we are a factor of 8 lower in the power that's required. So compared to other organic materials, we're much better. Now, it's those organic materials that give you the possibility of going to larger sizes. So that's the real benefit. In terms of energy savings, you know, just going to OLEDs from LCD gives you that.
And with your team's method, you wouldn't have to throw out 30%, like you said, you'd have to with the polycrystalline silicon.
I wish I could claim that we were there already, but we're sort of at the beginning of being able to exploit a whole new range of materials to tackle this problem. So that work hasn't been done yet, and that's sort of our next task.
What are the components of this light-emitting transistor, this drive transistor, that allow it to realize those voltage and power savings?
Well, we exploit carbon nanotubes. These are single-wall carbon nanotubes, but we use them not in the way that conventional nanotube transistors have been, or even nanotube network transistors have evolved previously. We use the nanotubes as the source electrode, as the electrode that injects the current into the organic channel material.
So you're not using the semiconducting properties of the carbon nanotubes at all?
That's exactly right. We're treating the nanotubes as if they're just a metal. They're kind of a unique metal in that you can, with the gate field, modulate their Fermi level, which changes the contact barrier that develops between the nanotubes and the channel material, the organic channel material. But other than that feature, we're certainly not using the semiconducting properties. And it's really the use of those carbon nanotubes that permit the device to function. The architecture of the transistor is a vertical architecture rather than a lateral architecture. In other words, so a transistor typically is a current control device that uses a voltage to regulate the current. And conventional thin film transistors have the two electrodes connected through the channel material that permits the current to flow. So the current goes from the source to the drain, controlled by the gate voltage. Now, the source, drain, and channel in the conventional design are lying next to each other on a surface in the lateral channel device. In our device, we sort of flip that architecture 90 degrees and put the source down, then we put the channel down, and then we put the top drain electrode down. Now, for a light-emitting transistor, we incorporate the OLED layers between the drain and the channel.
So is it that the light essentially is transmitting through the nanotubes, the layer of nanotubes?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
But let's talk about just the transistor for the moment. So in the transistor, in order to permit the gate field to penetrate to the channel layer, you have to have a somewhat of a porous source layer. In other words, if you had a continuous metal electrode, that would screen the gate field from ever reaching the channel material. By using carbon nanotubes and putting them down in a sufficiently dilute but easily percolating network, that permeability of the gate field is achieved. So really, the carbon nanotubes are critical to this. There are some more technical advantages that we describe in another paper.
Are these light-emitting transistors expensive to manufacture compared to current technologies?
Well, certainly as laboratory devices, they're expensive because, you know, these materials are not in commodities yet. But if this technology proves out, they would become commodities, and I'm sure the price would come down very quickly. In terms of manufacturing complexity, by integrating the drive transistor and the OLED, as our CN VOLET, as we call it, does, we get away from the requirement of an additional drive transistor. The device has capacitance, so we don't know this for sure just yet, but we may actually be able to do away with the storage capacitor. In the typical devices, the storage capacitor is there to maintain the voltage in the pixel until the next refresh cycle. So, you know, your TV monitor has to refresh like 60 or 70 hertz. The capacitance in our device, the intrinsic capacitance, may allow us to get away without a storage capacitor. So that would mean that all we would need, potentially, would be a switching transistor and the CN VOLET. And so that reduces the manufacturing complexity from, you know, four devices that you need to build on a chip or pixel down to two. So that could be a reasonably big benefit. There's another benefit that comes out of the reduction in the number of other components within the aperture of the pixel, and that is that in present devices, because the side-by-side drive transistor occupies real estate, the OLED can only be made so large. And so in order to get the same light output that you want, the bright light output, you've got to drive it harder. Well, that reduces its lifetime, right? I mean, these devices need to last at least, say, 10 years for consumers to want to purchase them. So, you know, lifetime is kind of a big issue. In our devices, having the light-emitting portion occupy more of the pixel aperture, we can drive it at a lower current density and thereby improve the anticipated lifetime of the devices.
Andrew Rinsler, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Robert.
Andrew Rinsler of the University of Florida Gainesville is senior author of a paper in this week's Science on low-voltage, low-power, organic light-emitting transistors for active matrix displays. Now, Science's Sarah Reardon is sitting in for David Grimm with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now, including a story about what causes crowd quakes. Sarah, first, what is a crowd quake?
Well, if you've ever been in a crowded concert, then you'll have probably experienced being carried along by the crowd or trapped between a large number of people, which is not the most pleasant experience, people are stampeding to get closer and closer to the stage, and it starts to become very dangerous as smaller individuals or even large ones get knocked over and trampled and crushed.
So is it just the number of people all being crammed in such a small area that causes them?
Yeah, a lot of the time, as more and more people try at the same time to get towards a destination, especially if there's a bottleneck such as an exit door, the risk of someone being knocked down and trampled becomes greater and greater.
So what's the latest research here?
Well, in building design and in planning for these crowd quakes, when you know that there's going to be a large number of people all rushing towards a certain area, there's been a need to understand how crowds work, how these dynamics work. And a lot of people for a long time have been trying to model this using certain particles and computer simulations. But the problem is particles aren't people. Particles don't do things like turn around to have a conversation. They don't stop and tie their shoes. They just move in the direction that you tell them to. These previous models haven't accounted for natural human behavior, and so they've largely failed in helping planners design for large numbers of people.
And now?
And now some researchers have put together a new computer model that accounts for human variability. And what they did was they, instead of looking at a pattern of particle flow, they looked at the particles as individuals, which might make different decisions depending on whether they were trying to weave through a small gap that they saw or might be turning around or moving a different direction. And by setting in a place of rules that each particle might or might not follow, they could make each particle closer and closer to a person. And so when they modeled this and then compared it with an actual crowd trying to get through a space, they found that this model came much closer to actual crowd dynamics than those before.
So the idea then is to incorporate this kind of model, these predictions of human movement, in the design of new buildings, or?
Well, it could be in the design of new buildings so that better routes could be taken. It also might help people at something like a concert understand where they should be putting security or where they should be watching for possible bottlenecks where people could get injured. And then another application could be for an autonomous robot that might be delivering, say, supplies through a crowded hospital, trying to tell this robot how it could best maneuver through a crowd of people that wouldn't be behaving in simple ways.
Okay, well, thanks, Sarah. So what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, we've got one that marks the one-year anniversary of the volcano eruption last April in Iceland that you probably remember. It shut down travel in Europe, air travel in Europe, for a very long time as people were concerned about safety of the planes and pilots' ability to see. This was the longest air shutdown in Europe since World War II. And so what's new here is that researchers have looked back now at the actual ash that was spewing that was the problem to try and assess, well, was this shutdown warranted? Because it disrupted a lot of lives, it cost a lot of money. And so what they did was they looked at these tiny particles of ash that had been collected, and they found that it has very, very sharp edges and knife-like properties that could have certainly damaged planes. And they even swirled the ash around in a beaker of water for 2 weeks and found that these knife-like edges didn't go away. They didn't break down over time. All they could do was wait for them to fall out of the sky.
Was there something particular about this ash that was different from ash of other volcanoes?
Well, one of the things that was unusual was that a larger percentage of the ash particles were smaller than most volcanoes. And because they were so small and powder-like, they were more likely to stay up in the air for longer and to get gummed up in turbines and cause planes to crash. And another interesting thing about this ash was because they were so small, they had a very large surface area onto which different gases could stick. These gases might be toxic, and many of them were specific to the region since they were coming off of a mix of lava and glacial meltwater that's specific to Iceland. And because these chemicals would have been staying up in the air for longer on the small particles, they could have been transported further and caused even more problems.
So in retrospect, it was a good idea to keep the airspace shut down for so long, or are scientists saying, you could have cut back?
Well, scientists seem to think that it's a very good idea, that it saved a lot of potential damage.
Does this provide then a methodology for deciding about future volcanic eruptions, what to do, and a timeline to wait?
I don't really think it does, because so many of characteristics of this were very specific to this particular volcano. But I imagine that scientists in the future could come back to this research as they're thinking about the composition of the ash of other volcanoes.
Okay. So last story. What's this last story about?
Well, the last story is about how fire ants can form rafts out of their bodies to float across the water.
allowing the ones that stay on top of the raft to survive?
So it's not really a matter of who's on top or below. All of the ants fall into the water together. They form a big sticky ball together by grabbing onto each other with their legs and whatnot. This ball sinks, but then floats up to the surface and spreads out into the raft. And because of the roughness of the surface, with all of the hair on their bodies and the legs sticking out, a lot of air gets trapped, air bubbles get trapped at the water's surface, allowing them, even the ones on the bottom, to be able to breathe.
So a mechanism for surviving a quick deluge, fire ants must encounter this kind of thing often.
Well, the ants come from Brazil, from the rainforest, where they would be being rained on constantly, and especially if your little ant doesn't take a whole lot of water to wash you away. But these ants are actually an invasive species in the U.S. and in some other regions as well. So even though we might associate them with living in the Southwest and there not being a whole lot of water around, this would be a very useful behavior for them in the rainforest where they came from.
Any potential applications from this research?
Well, the way in which these ants pack themselves together is very interesting for modeling scientists who want to understand how to create, a stronger boat or a more watertight fabric just by studying the way that they grab onto one another and their water-repellent properties of their shells and of the structure. Another interesting angle is how the ants assemble themselves in the first place, because these ants kind of act like a superorganism, not really thinking with their own minds, but just all working together as one to achieve a common goal.
Okay, well, thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, Rob.
Science's Sarah Ridden sitting in for David Grimm with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now. Find more stories, plus all the stories on the Science Policy blog, Science Insider, and join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Find it all at news.sciencemag.org. Finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is our letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, we start with a letter from our April 8th issue from scientists who are shocked and upset by the recent decision of the U.S. National Science Foundation to terminate the GK-12 program. A program that connects graduate students in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics with kindergarten to 12th grade students. Science's Jeffrey Mervis wrote about this decision in his March 4th article titled, "Outrage Greets NSF Decision to End STEM Fellows Program."
Raghavir Parthasarathi and colleagues from the University of Oregon write, "Ours is just one of many GK-12 programs nationwide that share the goal of improving science education. We find it remarkable that the entirety of GK-12 will be terminated, with focus redirected to NSF programs that partner academic scientists with local school districts. The local environs of universities are arguably the places least in need of additional outreach efforts."
"Our program," the authors write, "deploys graduate student fellows to rural Oregon elementary schools, where they live as scientists in residence with hosts for 2 weeks per academic quarter, during which they co-teach children alongside teachers, implementing professionally developed inquiry-based science curriculum kits, lesson plans, materials, and equipment. Because these schools are far from universities and other centers of science or technology, the GK-12 fellows are in many cases the only scientists the students have ever met. The teachers also have poor connections to experts and have little prior training in teaching hands-on, inquiry-based science. Working with fellows is crucial for adopting tools that will be effective after the fellows' departure. The program benefits the fellows by providing valuable training in communication and organization."
The authors conclude, "The publicly funded U.S. research infrastructure has been extremely successful in advancing scientific knowledge, but largely unsuccessful in developing a public understanding of science. The nation needs more, not fewer, programs like GK-12. You can read the full letter in the April 8th issue of Science.
Our next letter is from this week's issue and highlights the end of a 25-year-old collaboration between the University of Johannesburg and the Ben-Gurion University in Israel. Vladislav Alterman of the University of Pretoria in South Africa writes, "The University of Johannesburg has acted against its own and the South African national interest with the end of this collaboration. boycotts of Israeli scientists, science institutions, and worse, research cooperation between Palestinians and Israelis are counterproductive. They deprive those less fortunate of a chance for improvement in education, and they promote confrontation and tension between Arab and Israeli societies. Because of the political pressure they face, collaborative programs are dwindling. We should show strong support for the excellent examples of peaceful collaboration between Israeli and Palestinian scientists, as well as with scientists of other nations.
You can find Alterman's letter in this week's Science. Our final letter is also from this week's issue and is part of our Life and Science series. Brian Sidlauskas of Oregon State University and the Smithsonian Institution and colleagues from the University of Guyana and University of Toronto write about their success with identifying fish through the social network Facebook.
The authors write, "The Cuyuni River, which runs from Venezuela through Guyana and into the Atlantic via the Essequibo River, harbors hundreds of fish species. Although much of the river flows far from civilization, pollution from gold mining and other environmental hazards threaten its rich community of wildlife. Earlier this year, a small group of us from the United States and Guyana set out to perform the first comprehensive survey of the river's fishes, with support from the Biological Diversity of the Guiana Shield Program at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. We aimed to determine which species still thrived in the river, which might have disappeared, and whether any of the remote river's denizens were entirely new to science."
The authors continue, "We arrived in January during the dry season and embarked for 2 weeks of collecting and camping along 200 kilometers of rainforest-lined river. Local boatmen helped us navigate the often perilous river, and each day we stood neck-deep in the muddy waters and pulled wide nets to catch samples of life teeming beneath the surface. One student photographed each species as the collection grew to hundreds and then thousands of fishes, large and small. Upon returning to Georgetown, Guyana's capital, a major challenge confronted us. As a condition to securing an export permit, we had just 1 week to complete a detailed report with each of our 5,000 specimens identified to genus and species. Given the limited library resources at our disposal and the time constraint, the task seemed impossible."
The authors write, "Then, one of the students suggested posting our many photographs on Facebook and inviting the ichthyologists among our circle of friends to help us identify them. Would that far-flung community take the time to help us? We decided to find out. We posted the photographs, and within minutes, comments began to pour in. 'They look like fish to me,' one commenter cheerfully acknowledged. 'On an anchovy,' another noted, 'pizza topping.' But before long, more insightful messages began to appear. Amazed, we collected identifications from our friends and then from friends of friends, contributing their expertise from around the world."
The authors conclude, "Less than 24 hours later, 90% of our specimens were identified. Armed with our export permit, we packed our specimens for shipment and returned home, grateful beyond words for the generosity of our colleagues and for the social network that allowed us to harness their vast collective expertise and provide faster and more accurate identifications than we ever would have dreamed possible."
You can find Sidlauskas and colleagues' letter in this week's issue of Science.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor of Science Magazine. If you would like to submit a letter to Science, you can do so online at submit2science.org. That's submit2science.org. And that wraps up the April 29th, 2011 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.